It is great, with great pleasure that I chair this meeting because we have two accomplished speakers who will be speaking to you on topics of great interest for solicitors who practice in the tenancy law area. Before I introduce the two speakers, I'd like to do something I have never done in the last 30 years chairing meetings, because I had a most unusual experience last year when I was chairing a meeting with Bill Rimmer and Mitch McKenzie. After the meeting, the people lined up for question time, and I told one of the attendees, I said, do you mind if I answer your question? She said, no, I've come to speak to Mr. Rimmer. For the 40 years in doing property law, I had no sort of appeal to her. And I said, I've written a book, Pumar, The Sale of Land. And she said, oh, what was that? What's that? I wonder what she was doing in property law if she didn't know about Pumad. Now, I've been a silk for 10 years. I've been a barrister at the bar for 40, and I'm the author of Pumad, The Sale of Land, which, as you know, was recently, about 4 years ago, was inducted into one of the top 20 legal books ever written in Australia. It's the only property law book which has been run so. The only reason why I said that was taking a leaf out of General MacArthur's statement when he said that old soldiers never die, they only fade away. Old barristers never die, they only lose their appeal. Right? Now, we have two. The first speaker today is Robert Hay. He's been in practice for nearly 15 years, and he's just completed 10 years at the bar. So he's ready to take readers now. But he's got a big practice in commercial law, and he's the author of that celebrated book on commercial tenancy with Bradbrook and Clyde Croft. He's going to speak to you on repair covenants. And these are very interesting because a lot of people seem to think that there is a duty on the landlord to repair. I think Robert will put you all right on that score. I give you Robert. Okay.
This is a big area which I'd normally take about an hour to speak on, so I won't be dealing with everything in the paper. So at times I'll skip over things, but there's a lot of material in the paper. I was going to consider three issues: just repair and maintenance obligations at common law, briefly Section 52 of the Retail Leases Act. I've put a lot of detail in there about Section 52, and you may have attended talks in the past that I've done on Section 52 of the Retail Leases Act, and an issue that seems to be vexing a lot of people at the moment, and that is whether a landlord can recover the costs of complying with its obligations under the Building Act. In other words, recover costs from a tenant. Now, I find it very interesting that, and extraordinary really, how many tenants go into leases without getting advice, or the solicitors not giving them advice about the implications of repair covenants, and particularly the covenants at the end of the lease to make good. I've been involved in two cases in the last year where a tenant had no idea about these things and ended up having to pay out $200,000 to $300,000 in each case to make good. So the first point I want to make is this. There's a very old case which is still the law in Victoria, and I'll just briefly outline it to you. It's a case called Joiner and Weeks. The plaintiff brought an action against the defendant upon a covenant in a lease that the defendant would leave the premises in repair at the end of the lease. When the lease came to an end, the premises were out of repair, so that there was a breach of the covenant, who paid £45 into court. This is a very old case, as I said. The plaintiff proved before the official referee that the cost of putting the premises into repair was £70, but the defendant alleged that the plaintiff was entitled only to nominal damages upon the ground that he had demised the premises to a third party, who had covenanted to pull down and rebuild the premises and also to pay a higher rent than the defendant had paid. And you'd think that's a pretty good argument, wouldn't you? That's the landlord's real loss. The defendant therefore contended that the want of repair in which he'd left the premises at the end of the term had caused no damage to the plaintiff. The official referee gave the plaintiff a farthing in damages and gave the defendant all the costs of the action. It was held by the Court of Appeal that the measure of damages was the amount which the landlord proved to be the fair and reasonable sum necessary to put the premises into the state of repair in which he was entitled to have them left. In other words, he got £70. Now, that's still the law in Victoria. The prima facie position is, at the end of a lease, if there's a make good obligation, the landlord is entitled to the cost of putting the premises in the condition they should have been in, irrespective of whether the landlord has really suffered any loss. And the logic for that is this. I'm just reading from another case. It is true that sum paid by the tenant is often a sum preposterous in relation to the real damage to the landlord, as where he's going to pull down the premises, and therefore is not the loser by a penny because they are returned on his hands out of repair. In such a case, the rule of law may amount to putting into the landlord's pocket money far beyond the damage which he's actually suffered. But it must be remembered that there are difficulties on the other side, and that but for this rule of law, a tenant who's broken his contract might come off better than if he had kept it, a result not to be lightly encouraged. It is not surprising that of the two principles the Court of Appeal has chosen, that was in Joiner of Weeks, that which they believe to be the workable one, and that is at the end of the term, no matter how indifferent it may be to the landlord whether the premises are in perfect order or not, yet if the repairing covenants are not performed, the landlord is entitled to recover the amount necessary to put them into repair. Now, that's the prima facie position. And so it can be altered, but that's the starting point. And tenants have no idea about this. Tenants also, and many solicitors I deal with, assume that there are implied covenants that a landlord has to put premises in a state of repair at the commencement of the tenancy. The landlord has no such obligations. In the absence of an express lease covenant, a landlord is usually under no obligations to repair leased premises. There have been the rare exception where terms have been implied, because a lease is a contract and you can imply terms. In a decision called Carbura, which I mentioned here in paragraph 3, Justice Barnford there I refer to as having doubted whether it's possible to imply into a simple lease where there is no relationship between the parties other than that of landlord and tenant, an obligation on the landlord to repair and maintain the structure of the leased premises. So that's the starting position. Often you'll find a lease where a landlord does have some repairing covenants, but it's normally to the exterior of the premises only. And traditionally, landlords are only liable once they're given notice. So they're not, just because there's the repair covenants that the landlord's liable to do certain things, if they're not given notice, normally there's no liability that accrues to the landlord. I won't go into the meaning of repair. You can all look at all that. I've got that in the lease there. I've got that in the paper there. Many of you would be aware that tenants' repairing covenants are normally onerous, invariably horrendously onerous. Common covenants include keeping in good and substantial repair, keeping in thorough repair and good condition, deliver up the premises well and substantially repaired, repair, maintain and keep the premises in good and substantial repair, having regard to the premises at the commencement of the lease. Now, if the tenant's required to keep premises in repair, that means at all times. It's not the fact that you can repair once and say you've complied with your covenant. The tenant has to comply at all times. If the tenant's leased an old building, it's not enough. The tenant can't escape liability by saying, I've leased an old building. It doesn't matter. You've got to keep it in repair. If it says in good repair, that's quite an onerous covenant because even though it's old, it's still got to be kept in good repair. Of course, a covenant to repair doesn't oblige a tenant to rectify design defects or require the tenant to renew things, except in the case where there mightn't be a product that can be used to repair, and in fact the only product available might be a new product. Or alternatively, say if building standards have changed and to put it in the state of repair it was in can't be done, you might need to get a new product. Now, the May 2009 Law Institute lease, the 2009 revision, is quite onerous from the tenant's point of view. Requires the tenant to keep the premises in the same condition as at the start of the lease, except for fair wear and tear. The critical thing is, in the Law Institute lease, the start of the lease is defined to be the first day of the term. But if this lease is a renewal under an option in an earlier lease, the starting date of the first lease is the relevant date. So, if you've got a tenant that's going to be has been in premises for 10 years, say, you've got to put the premises in the condition they were in 10 years ago. That's a difficult and expensive thing to do in many instances. There's always a problem in these cases, though, and landlords fall into this trap of not having a good record of what the condition was at the start, because it's obviously necessary to prove that to succeed in a case against the tenant. You can't normally get an order for specific performance of repair covenants. Damages is the usual remedy. Now, the position's changed a little under the Retail Leasing Act, and I'll come to that later. If the landlord breaches an obligation under a repair covenant, the tenant may bring an action for damages without first doing the work and then sue the landlord for damages. I've already illustrated for you the measure of damages when premises are not left in repair at the end of the lease. If a repair covenant is breached during the term of the lease, as opposed to the making good covenants at the end, the measure of damages is the diminution in value of the premises by the failure to repair. So you're not looking at the cost to repair, you're looking at the failure, you're looking at the loss in value of the premises. Now, all that is set out in the paper. Now, I'm going to move on to the Retail Leasing Act, because there's a provision in there that substantially changes the common law, section 52, and you'll see it set out in paragraph 15. I'll read it. The landlord is responsible for maintaining in a condition consistent with the condition of the premises when the lease is entered into, A, the structure of and fixtures in the retail premises lease, plant and equipment, appliances, fittings and fixtures provided under the lease by the landlord relating to gas, electricity, water, drainage or other services. And then there's a whole lot of provisions which I set out in paragraph 16, which enables the tenant, if the landlord fails to do the work, the tenant to go and do the work and recover that money from the landlord. The landlord's liable to reimburse the tenant for the reasonable costs of the repairs. So, this changes the common law. The landlord now has statutory obligations, and the way the Retail Leases work, Retail Leases Act works is that the obligation is an implied term into the lease. Now, you'll note at the bottom there of the page, page 5, and this note appears in the statute. It says, Section 39 regulates the ability of the landlord to recover outgoings, including the cost of repairs. Section 41 provides that capital costs are not recoverable by a tenant, from a tenant. Now, I'll be coming back to this because it's been a big issue about whether a landlord can recover from a tenant the cost of the landlord complying with Section 52. What does Section 52 entail? Paragraph 17. This is what then Deputy President McNamara had to say. Reliance on Section 52 of the Retail Leases Act necessarily entails a comparison of the condition of fixtures, services and so forth at the time the complaint is made against their condition when the relevant lease was entered into. So I mentioned earlier, you have to be able to work out the condition at the commencement of the lease, often a very difficult thing to do. And if you get involved in these cases, settle them, because they turn into massive building cases with experts and all sorts of people. Some barristers down there I know have run up costs of $150,000 running these kind of cases in VCAT, so avoid them, try and resolve them. Now, when is the lease entered into? As an example, if the tenant occupies the premises for 5 years and exercises an option for a further 5 years, what's the relevant date that you assess the condition of the premises? Is it at the commencement of the first term or at the commencement of the second term of 5 years? This was dealt with in a case called Ross Hunt, where, again, Deputy President McNamara, he held that in that case, the relevant date was the date the new term commenced. In other words, it's not very helpful for tenants. It wasn't the original commencement of the lease. The commencement date was the date of the renewal. So it means that tenants have to really keep on top of this situation. There's no point in allowing a five-year lease to be with a five-year option to be in its eighth year before you make a complaint, because you're only going to get the premises put in the condition they were in three years prior to that. So each time a lease is renewed, Section 52 will be triggered. Now, there are arguments, I think, that can overcome that problem, and that is, I mentioned to you that Section 52 is an implied term in the lease. The term is implied, so I think it's quite open to argue that if the landlord didn't comply with its obligation under the first in the first five-year term, assume you're in the second five-year term, the tenant should be able to say, look, the starting condition for the second five-year term should be what it was supposed to be in at the beginning, because the landlord can't rely on its own wrong. If the landlord failed to comply with its contractual obligations in the first term, it can't rely on doing its own wrong to say, oh, no, we don't have to put it back in that standard. Now, there are cases which I set out in this paper towards the end there where you'll see that argument has been run but under other guises. I won't be taking you to the cases because we don't have time, but I've set them all out in great detail in the paper. What does Section 52 require a landlord to do? Well, it was originally a provision that required a landlord to be responsible for maintaining premises in good repair. So it was a much higher standard. But that was changed when tenants of government buildings up in the high country, in the snow country, who were leasing places for peppercorn rent, found out they could make the government put these chalets and ski lodges in a good condition. So the government promptly changed the law. So they only have to be maintaining the condition they're in at the commencement of the lease. Now, keep in repair, it's now a keep in repair obligation, as at the commencement of the lease, could mean in extreme circumstances that the only course open to a landlord is to replace some aspect of the premises. For example, as I said, if building standards have changed, so putting it back in the original state of repair would be in breach of building standards. It often occurs with roofs and things like that. Now, it's easy in general terms to describe this type of covenant, but its application isn't so clear. For example, what happens, and I'm looking at paragraph 25, if a landlord leases a service station to a tenant that has four underground petrol tanks, after the lease commences, one tank is abandoned and replaced by the landlord with a new tank. Then the new tank becomes contaminated and unusable. What's the position? Can the landlord contend that Section 52 doesn't apply to the new tank because it was installed after the lease was commenced? Remember the relevant issues going back to the commencement date? The answer is no, because the comparison is not between the condition of a particular fixture or appliance, but with the condition of the premises as a whole. There was four working petrol tanks at the beginning. There's got to be four working petrol tanks now. Now, there's authority on that. You'll see that in the footnote. I'm just trying to, having regard to the time, I'm just working out which bits I should deal with. I'd mentioned earlier that at common law, you don't normally get specific performance for breach of a repair covenant. The position can change in VCAT because under the Retail Leases Act, section 91 of the Act, I'm looking at paragraph 28 of the paper, enables the tribunal to require a party to do or not do anything, including to provide specified facilities, surfaces, fixtures or fittings under a retail premises lease. And in a case called Computer and Parts, the senior member undertook a very sensible approach to one of these cases. The tenant had turned up and said, look, I'm not in a position today to quantify the loss, so could you just make a decision based on liability and we'll have to come back and have a fight later about how much it's going to cost to repair. And the member said, no, I'm not going to do that. Under Section 91, I can order someone to do something. And what I'm going to do now is make an order that if the landlord is found to be liable, I will order the landlord to do the repairs. In other words, the decision on that point came out before the question of whether the landlord was liable. But it was a sensible approach because it saved everyone a lot of money and got a quick result. Because Section 52 implies obligation into the leases, the question often arises about whether a landlord's failure to comply with Section 52 can constitute repudiatory conduct. The answer is yes. And I deal with paragraph 29. You'll see there's quite a discussion there about that. There's also an interesting issue which has emerged. Many of you would know that leases generally require a tenant to pay rent without deduction. And that normally means that you can't set off a cross-claim as a defence to a failure to pay rent. So you can't say, look, I've got a good claim against the landlord. I don't have to pay rent because I'm not going to set off my claim against the landlord. Well, in Victoria anyway, and most of Australia now, the position is normally a tenant can't set off rent an obligation to pay rent against damages because if the clause provides pay without deduction. Well, that won't apply to a breach of Section 52. Because you recall Section 52, the tenant can recover its costs of doing the work. Section 94 of the Retail Leases Act says that any provision that's contrary to or inconsistent with the Act is void. And in a case called Delaveras, Deputy President McNamara said the failure to pay rent wasn't fatal to the tenant, and it could set off its claim because of a set off its claim for damages because of a failure by the landlord to comply with what was then in section 52. So the tenant's damages claim for the landlord failing to comply with section 52 can be set off against a failure to pay rent, even if the lease says pay rent without deduction. Now, this is the difficult question that emerged with section 52. Can the landlord recover its costs? And this is relevant to the Building Act point too. Section 39 of the Act, and I'm looking at paragraph 31, says the tenant under a retail premises lease is not liable to pay an amount to the landlord in respect of outgoings except in accordance with the provisions of the lease that specify the outgoings that are to be regarded as recoverable in a manner consistent with the regulations, etc., etc. Then section 41 of the Act renders void a provision in a lease to the extent that it requires the tenant to pay an amount in respect of capital costs. So you can't force a tenant to pay capital costs. I'm just going through this because it's going to be relevant to the discussion I'm about to enter into. However, a provision in a lease that requires the tenant to undertake capital costs at the tenant's own cost is not void. In other words, you could say to a tenant, you've got to build this thing or you've got to put this item into the building, but what you can't do is say, you've got to contribute to my costs, that is the landlord's capital costs. You can't do that. So, the question arose in a case called Cafe Dansk, which is I refer to in paragraph 33, about whether a landlord complying with section 52 could recover its costs from the tenant using the provisions in the Retail Leases Act. And this is what Deputy President McNamara had to say. I find Dr. Croft's sceptical views on this point compelling. It would, in my view, make a mockery of Section 52. If Parliament, having allocated the responsibility for certain repairs to the landlord could then send the bill to the tenant for the cost of carrying out those repairs. To attempt to reach this unlikely result would, by reliance on a note at the end of the section, that's the note I took you to, is to quote Lord Salmon like trying to suspend a 3-ton truck from a cobweb. Even if I were wrong on this point, the strategy for a landlord to recover the costs of compliance with his Section 52 obligations from the tenant would depend on there being a covenant in the lease making these amounts recoverable as outgoings. In this case, that wasn't there. So strictly speaking, the Deputy President's comments are obito. But the argument is not nearly as flimsy as the Deputy President suggested, because the explanatory memorandum, which he wasn't referred to in that case, the explanatory memorandum to the Act actually makes it clear that the intention was that a landlord should be able to recover costs of complying with Section 52 from the tenant. And that was certainly the view of a lot of the people involved with the drafting of the Act, and I'm sure that sometime this year there'll be a challenge to the view that a landlord can't recover those costs. I'm sure a case will arrive in VCAT. Now, next in the paper, I list a whole lot of cases where Section 52 has been dealt with in detail. You'll find a lot of them concern gymnasiums and things. Perhaps I'll just do one. It's called My Club. After commencement of the lease, the premises were reconfigured from office space to a gymnasium. When the lease was entered into, the air conditioning system was old, but it introduced fresh air from the outside. The landlord installed new air conditioning units, but they didn't introduce fresh air from the outside. There were more exacting air conditioning standards for premises used as gymnasiums than for premises used as office space. Remember I said it changed from office space to a gym. The tribunal accepted that the landlord wasn't required to upgrade the air conditioning, but the landlord was required to provide air conditioning that brought air in from the outside. So the landlord lost that case. The next one is a computer parts case. There's several of those. This one concerned air conditioning problems and roof leaks. Now, what was interesting here is there had been a special provision had been included in the lease that required the landlord to ensure that electrical work, air conditioning, heating and cooling equipment were in working order at the beginning of the lease. So what happened here was the landlord didn't comply and then sought to argue, well, the condition was pretty bad and that's the condition the tenant's entitled to. And VCAT said, no, sensibly said, no, you were going to put this in good repair and that's the standard I'm holding you to. So the starting standard was the standard that the landlord had contractually bound itself to do. And that's the point I made earlier. Remember I said the Section 52 implies terms into leases, And if in an earlier term the landlord hasn't complied, it seems to me you should be able to say, look, the landlord can't rely on its own wrong in failing to comply under an earlier term of this lease. The standard has to be that which it would have been in if the landlord had complied with its obligations. This is a case too which discusses the issue about replacement parts. In the absence of adequate second-hand parts, you might have to have new parts. It was bad luck for a landlord if legislative standards had changed and required a higher standard than would have originally applied. It's the tenant can't argue the landlord's received a betterment. It's just bad luck. All right, now I'm going to move on to the issue which has vexed lots of people recently, and that's the Building Act. There was an article in the Law Institute Journal in April which suggested that a landlord could not cover its costs that it incurs in complying with the Building Act from a tenant. Now, I think there's been a few things have got confused in all of this. The confusion starts with Section 52.251 of the Act, which provides this. If the owner of a building or land is required under this Act or the regulations to carry out any work or do any other thing, and the owner does not carry out the work or do the thing, the occupier of that building or land or any registered mortgagee of the land may carry out the work or do the thing, a bit like Section 52. And the occupier may recover any expenses necessarily incurred from the owner as a debt due to the occupier and deduct those expenses from or set them off against any rent. And this section applies despite any covenant or agreement to the contrary. Now, as many of you would be aware, the Building Act requires owners of buildings to do lots of things. And there's quite a lot of complex material in the Act about essential safety measures. Now, in my view, the effect of Section 251 is this, that if the owner is required by the Building Act or the regulations to carry out any work, and the owner doesn't do the work or carry out the thing, the tenant can do the work, that's what the section says, and the landlord can do the work the landlord was obliged to do and recover the costs from the landlord. The tenant can set off those costs against the rent. The usual rent covenant that rent must be paid without deduction will not assist the landlord if it fails to comply with Section 251 and the tenant does the work that the landlord was obliged to do, and that all emerges from a case called Chen. In Chen, the landlord was obliged to fix smoke detectors under the Building Act. The lease itself required the tenant to do that work. The Deputy President McNamara said, no, I'm not going to have this situation. And he ordered the landlord to do the work and said the landlord couldn't force the tenant to do the work. Because it obviously makes sense. The statute was applying the obligation to the landlord. Now, this is where the difficulties have emerged. As a result of that case and this article that appeared in April, the question arises whether the landlord can, under appropriately drawn provisions containing the lease, pass on to the tenant the cost that it's liable to pay the tenant if Section 251 has been enlivened. Now, remember, Section 251 only applies when the landlord doesn't do the work. Now, it's absolutely clear in my view that the landlord could never recover those costs from the tenant. That is, the ones the costs that arise because the tenant does the work. The Act clearly envisages that the tenant is able to recover those costs from the landlord, and it would make a nonsense if the landlord could then get those costs back from the tenant. And that's Chen partly dealt with that. That's what Chen was dealing with. The more difficult question is whether a building owner can recover from the tenant the owner's cost of the situation where the owner complies with the Building Act. What happens when the owner complies with the Building Act? The tenant hasn't had to do anything. Now, in my view, the landlord can recover those costs. This is where I think that article went a bit haywire. The Building Act is concerned with safety. It says nothing about cost recovery. And it's not clear to me why the costs shouldn't be able to be recovered from the tenant, provided the lease, remember I took you to Section 39, has provisions which enable those costs to be recovered. There's also a common law presumption that common law rights shouldn't be taken away by Parliament unless the legislature makes it clear that that's what the legislature intends. Now, there's nothing in the Building Act that would indicate Parliament intended to take away a landlord's rights to pass costs of complying with the Building Act onto the tenant. Nothing in the Act at all. Now, the contrary view is that people who take the contrary view will point to what Deputy President McNamara said in Cafe Dansk, referred to in paragraph 33 of the paper. You recall in that case he said the landlord couldn't recover from the from the tenant the costs of complying with section 52. I don't actually agree with Cafe Dansk, but I think the position's much clearer with the Building Act, and because it's just about ensuring the buildings are safe. There's nothing in there at all about cost recovery. Thank you. I could have spoken a lot more, but we don't have time. Thank you.